1 at 11. We're going to do some underwriting real quick, and then we are going to get to In the Know.
This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Green Yoga Spa. Green Yoga Spa brings relaxation to Champaign-Urbana. Green Yoga Spa offers massage, including personal, deep tissue, couples, and prenatal. They also offer Thai yoga therapy, personal yoga instruction, nutritional coaching, Reiki, reflexology, naturopathic services, and mobile spa services.
For more information, head to greenyogaspa.com or call 217-367-9642.
You are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. You're tuned into In the Know, a public affairs radio show. I always try to have a good message at the top of the hour to tell you what we talk about on this show, but we talk about so much and in so many different ways, it's hard to really have a good way of explaining it. We talk about a lot of things that don't get talked about in a very real, candid way, and so this is the platform to do that. The views expressed on the show, of course, are those of the guest and the host and not of WEFT Champaign. Tonight, I think it's hard to say what we're going to talk about. We're going to kind of go wherever things go. But the guest I have on tonight was on when we talked about the elections, and there was just so much that needed to still be discussed. We decided to have Gus back on to talk about it more. So I'm going to have you introduce yourselves, explain all the wonderful work you have done and are currently doing in CU.
Wow. this is rough. To keep the show going, I'll be brief with it because I've been doing a lot of work here since I've been here for 5 years. I'm Gus Wood. I'm currently a PhD candidate in the Departments of History, African-American Studies. I'm also currently on the exec board of the AFL-CIO. I'm a member of the Speak Truth Collective, member of the North End Breakfast Club. Past co-president of the Graduate Employee Organization Union on campus, which this year we just won the largest strike in university history. I was the strike coordinator for that and one of the lead negotiators on the bargaining team. I've been a part of tons of movements here, the Fight for 15, the more recent one, the Matt Rush Must Go campaign, the Stephen Salida campaign. That was one of my first ones I was involved in. And so, yeah, I've been doing as much as possible for a long time now. And that's what my research really looks at. It looks at social movements in urban areas and takes a more radical approach to understanding how best that we can alleviate a lot of the current issues that we're going through right now as our conditions continue to deteriorate at a rapid level. Not seen since the 1800s, what we call the new nadir from Professor Sundiata Chajua. So, yeah, just to keep it brief in that way. There are other things as well, but I'm ready to get started.
So what are the things that you talked about that I, you know, Sundiata has been on my show before, but I've read about some of that. So explain his work you just mentioned.
Sure.
So people kind of have an understanding of what we're talking about, because I think, you know, you hear about campaigns and initiatives, and a lot of times people just discount it as buzzwords, like, oh, yeah, that's the new fad trend, you know, that's what they're working on now. But this is long-term work for, yes, a lot of people, understanding not just what we're doing now, but where we've come from and why it's so important to do this work, you know, where the gaps were in previous work. Because I think we can all agree that, you know, women's movement, civil rights, those were such strong movements. And there's so much that still can always be learned from yes, that work. But other movements that have come along that haven't been as successful, we can also learn from those as well.
Oh,
so
definitely.
Just because somebody wasn't successful in their initiative doesn't mean that it isn't important to now.
Oh, no, of course. Oh, yeah. I'm a firm believer in, regardless of, and then differentiating between moment and movement, whereas in times when moments occur that could have transformed into movements but didn't,
right,
for various whatever reason must be, we have to study that, because what's happening is that people are getting a misinterpretation of what a movement is and not understanding the capacity of what it takes to do it. Because as you said, it's usually a long term. Most social movements based on, I use Sundiata Chajua's, Alden Morris's, Craig Calhoun, these people, these scholars, these activists, all of these are radical activists. They all agree that most movements last between 5 to 7 years. So it's a long time. You know? So you may be in the midst of something in the first or second year where it's at the infra-political level, that first phase where there's a lot of anger about something and people are upset. And they may turn to satire or jokes. They may turn to going online and complaining, or they may just meet and just have it out with each other about their anger. But it's not coalesced into a goal. Okay, what is this that we're trying to get accomplished? How do we get to this point? And what can we do to fix it? And once that vehicle is created, then you have the beginnings of a movement. Then you have to pick the local leadership. You have to assign roles. And the most important thing is you have to determine the institution of agency, the space in the community where the resources for the movement can be held and can be accessed by various groups. So they can't solely be for adults, right? Or they can't solely be for academics. You know, they have to be very diverse to the fact that everybody from whatever age, whatever demographic they come from in that particular space or movement can access those things. Right. And then you have that movement and you have the plan put in place. But like you say, it takes so much work. It takes a lot of meetings. It takes a lot of discussion, debates, and arguments, of course. And I think that that's one of the most important things that we have to recognize is that most, both successful and unsuccessful movements and have been born in struggle. There has to be some disagreement, some argument, some determination about how this is going to operate. And we have young people getting into organizations and groups that are being told that, you know, you can't argue here, or you can't debate here, or that this existing leadership makes the decisions and whatnot. And that's very detrimental to the development of young activists. But it also is counterproductive to the building of the movement itself. So there's a lot of things happening, and in the work that I do in relation to social movements is to bring an honest and open analysis, both theoretical and practical, in how to build a successful movement in 2018 as we continue to lose so many resources and really find that for the first time in at least a century, all aspects of the federal government now are dead set on dehumanizing by delegitimizing our spaces, taking away our resources. We haven't had to face a moment like this in quite some time. And so we have to analyze it and understand it so as to fight it and win. And we can't solely individualize the Trump regime as being that group. What they are doing is they are exacerbating some already toxic relationships and toxic political economy problems that have come from this structure and what it's done over the past 20, 30 years, going back to Reagan. Every single president, every single federal government regime is responsible for building the pathway to bringing back fascist rule in the United States, unfortunately.
Divide and conquer.
Divide and conquer. And also this dehumanizing hatred for fellow people. Something that, you know, you never thought you'd see, but you're always seeing these stories now about how somebody's calling the police on somebody who they think shouldn't be around, or somebody is literally confronting someone in a space, either physically or verbally, abusing these people solely because, I mean, you know, just because of their ideological beliefs, when in fact those beliefs are false from the get-go. They've been manufactured by the ruling class, but they still create this beef, this element of rage against each other that is just it's really fascinating to study this moment, to understand how to fight it when it's so new.
Well, I think it's, you know, going back to, you know, the comment you made about people just picking up the phone and calling 911 because they don't like who they see in the park across the street. Yeah. One of the people who I'm friends with on Facebook who is involved in local politics had said that, I don't know if it was his quote or if it was a quote from something he was posting, but it said, "Why are white people using the police like customer service?" Yeah. And I sat there and I was telling a friend of mine and I thought, wow, that's something right there. Here's that's deep because why are we not coping?
Yeah.
Basic, you know, I'm a therapist, so I look at it from behavior and I look at it from mindset, and I'm thinking, you have a problem, and your need for instant gratification, instant satisfaction, instant whatever it is, you pick up the phone and you call somebody because you don't know what's going on across the street. You don't want to. What happened to the back in the day when, and I'm thinking from my parents who were born in the 30s, just walk across the street, introduce yourself, say, hey, what's up? How's it going? Why have we moved so far away from that? And I think that's where things are, what I see, you know, of us being able to have this conversation and call this out, because people, we are setting a deadly precedent. That's how I see it.
Very true.
Are seeing a very deadly precedent right now of people acting before they really unpack and think about what they're looking at. And they automatically just assume, which, as they say, you know, if you assume something, it makes an ass out of you and me. So why are we doing that? Why are we in this stage where if you don't agree with something, why are we not trying to figure out how to have a middle ground? Because we, you know, we've seen bumper stickers for years coexist. Where do we lose that?
That's a great question. I'm a firm believer in this idea of a middle ground being kind of a dead end for many reasons. Number one, when you look at the basis of human society, the basis for human society and our ability to survive are based on material interests, plain and simple. The struggle for those material interests has created the socially constructed views of society, racism, just really mutated versions of misogyny and whatever else that's come about, versus, I mean, just all these different things that come about to keep us divided over time, right? The issue is that when you look at those material interests in the stage of what this country does more than anything else is production and creating profit. We know that this country profits off of everything that it creates, no matter what. To have any type of community, to have any type of the things that we need to survive, besides food, water, and shelter, we need security.
Mm-hmm.
We need agency. We need basic. We need other things like healthcare. All these other things that will make our quality of lives better, and we can live how we're supposed to live as being human beings. But the powers that be, since historically, since the creation of this country, those types of interests have always been conflicting or contradictory. Like, they can never meet in the middle. That's why they created the slave codes in the 1705 after Bacon's rebellion in the first place. It's because they recognized that black and white workers were working together. They sat down, they talked about their grievances of being oppressed by the ruling class, the British elite and the king, and said, no, we're going to topple these things, because they refuse to listen to our interests. They refuse to adhere to the fact that we are being treated horribly. Workers are dying. People were starving to death. So yeah, they worked together. When the British king saw this, he said, you know what? We got to make it to where their interests are no longer the same anymore. Because right now, their interests are unified, and they have a powerful force because there's a lot more workers than it is rulers. So we have to divide the workers, and we have to shift the interests. So the first slave codes come out in the late 1600s. The first official law basically creating and condoning racism, 1705 slave code, is one of the most important legal precedents set in world history, because it literally created racism. And so when you do that, you're not only justifying hatred, but you're also creating a new step system that says that our interests as white people will not be the same interest as black people, because literally they're the super exploited and the super oppressed black folks who have laws against them doing things that white people can't do, that completely that divides the interest. So again, that's literally what history in the United States has been about from the get-go. It has been violence. It has been dividing workers along racial lines, gender lines as well, so that we cannot align and see that we're all being oppressed by the same small group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what it's all about. So when we fast forward to today and we're saying, why can't we find a middle ground? It's because there really is no middle ground for us to exist on. If we want agency, if we want things that will make our lives better, free education, an actual society where we can police ourselves without creating an external force that, by the way, is being privatized, but having our own community self-defense, being able to determine our own or being able to own our own production. These are things that contradict the very existence of this structure. So there is no middle ground. The problem with us is that we continue to try to find middle ground when the ruling class said back in 1700, no, there's no rule. There is no middle ground. When they wrote the Constitution as law, the legal document that controls everything we've done for the past 400 years, when they sat in that room and said, no, there's not going to be any middle ground. This is the way it's going to be. We are going to remove the power from people to make decisions for themselves. So by create that document alone is basically stating between the lines, there is no middle ground. This is the law of the land. So the only way that we can find middle ground and actually make things beneficial for people is if we critique the structure of the country and try to build something alternative.
Yes. And I think, you know, people don't recognize the divide and conquer that we're seeing. I think what we typically see is people thinking, oh, well, this, you know, this group has their own agenda. Let them have their own agenda. We'll have our own agenda over here. But not recognizing that that's exactly what the point is for people to seemingly have different agendas, even though, like your example with the laborers, it's kind of the same agenda.
Yeah.
But it's been made to look very different based on the people who are, you know, as they call reflective listening. The reflective listening is actually gaslighting. It really is.
That's
it's
right.
Making it seem like we all have different agendas. No, actually, we have the same agenda. We just want what we think everybody else wants, which is, goes back to that materialistic view of we just want to have like our health care and our health needs met, and we want to have a good living wage so we can afford this and be able to have kids. But it's, again, it's that gaslighting that we've seen over history. And we're in a very unfortunate situation right now where I don't think they even are trying to necessarily utilize gaslighting. I think they're just saying, this is just the way it's going to be. And this is the way we need you to accept it. And if you want to make things easier for yourself, here's how you fall in line and march like a good soldier.
Yeah, there are historical reasons behind that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the unfortunate part where, you know, when he got elected, there were a lot of people who were, you know, insanely devastated by this for a ton of reasons. But for me, I kept saying the silver lining I'm hoping we'll see is that we see more grassroots efforts, that people try to not forget the fact that you can make a difference every day in your own community, even if we have to do it one community at a time. Because I think when you look at how powerful our federal government is and how the change they make can be so huge, and it feels like just everything's raining down, people forget that as individuals, we still have the power to do what we need to do.
Yeah.
We just have to figure out, again, like you were saying, how we organize, how we find those agents of change who can be our stakeholders and our backers, however we need to get this done.
Sure.
But I think that's where people get lost. It just gets overwhelming, or they feel like, well, you've seen this, you know, this initiative come before and it didn't work. So what are we going to do?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of historical reasons behind that as well. I mean, the idea, you know, first of all, you know, the good thing about the grassroots or the local working class community organizing was that it was going on before Trump was elected, because things were already really bad economically, socially, et cetera. I mean, like, we saw the skyrocketing of police shootings under the last president's regime,
right,
and nothing was done about it except the creation of a makeshift civil rights commission that didn't really do anything.
Right.
So things got bad. So there were a lot of responses to that. And we also saw the people who were not bailed out from the housing crisis. Remember, the banks were bailed out. So you have one of the largest housing crisis in U.S. history happening. And so there's been a lot of really good organizing around co-op housing and trying to alleviate some of those concerns as well. So you always have historical, particularly in the African-American community, a historical internal need to organize, because quite frankly, we've always been oppressed. So we've always had to organize. So it basically has become, it's become second nature. It's like blinking your eyes. Like we have to make sure that we are collective and that we are secure, because there are always things ready to take our resources away or to do bodily or emotional harm to us in some way. And nowadays, psychological, something that people don't talk about. So there's always been that aspect. And so there were existing struggles on the ground after Trump was elected that other groups could become a part of, and also grow other ones as well. So that's the best part about it. Malcolm X Grassroots is really one of the best organizations out there right now that are leading local struggles and actually winning some very good things for people. The Huey P. Newton Club in Texas is another really awesome group that's starting to spread and expand worldwide in terms of community self-defense, opening up kind of like a makeshift health center so people can get blood pressure screenings for free, diabetes screenings, and health screenings, all that stuff. So there's some really good stuff happening there. But in terms of the way people are getting lost in the shuffle, I think a lot of it comes to what we talked about before I came on the show, is that people are so focused on the national struggle, the federal struggle, that, you know, they see this president elected, they see the cabinet he selects, and they don't think about what's happening locally. Mm-hmm. See, the problem with struggle is that if you try to attack it on a more broad scale, or you only focus on a broad scale, you're going to see very little results.
Right.
Because that's just the way scale and proximity and spatial configuration works. Simple as that.
Well, and you're talking about antiquated systems that we've decades been working on making them change. So why would you expect it to be overnight? So
exactly.
Like work locally, like you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like trying to build a house starting with the roof.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. You have to have a foundation, and you build on that foundation till you get to the roof. So you start locally. And again, so I'm going to go into some more of the stuff I was talking about with Alden Morris and others, and the work I've seen done. You start locally with whatever the major issues are in the area. You have to do a study of the area. What are people saying? You have to talk to folks. You have to hold town hall meetings, and the people are going to have issues. In Champaign, a lot of big issues are coming out of, in terms of jobs. Employment is a big one that people are talking about. So having those types of discussions and building a platform off of that study, where are we at racially in terms of racial segregation? Where are we at educational funding? Where are we at in terms of our tax base? In other words, where are our resources at in this area, so we can determine where we could attack so that we can build? And once those things are found, then you build a movement. And through that movement, this is the big part. This is where you find the local leaders, because people are going to step up and want to take charge, and they're going to have the interests of the movement at heart. They're not going to come in with their preconceived notions of my ideology is more important than the movement. No, they have to adhere to the fact that the movement has a goal. So this helps make sure that you can have both liberals and radicals working together, and you can have radicals who have different perspectives. You got Marxists, Leninists, and Trotskyists, and all these other folks. You can have all working together if the goal is the number one thing. So you have people building on that. You have these leaderships, and you have the movement. You have 2 to 3 years where things are really pumping. You're starting to get some traction. There's pressure on the city council. There's pressure on the city manager, all these groups, to actually do what the goal of the movement is. So mm-hmm. It's really there. You have leadership now that you can take and say, you know what? Now that we know that you are going to represent our interests more than anything else, maybe we can start looking at you in a more electoral mode mm-hmm. at that point. You know, maybe, again, I'm one of the firmest non-believers in electoral politics, mainly because people only focus on the national level more than anything else, when nationally you don't have the right to select who your leaders are. The Electoral College removes your right to choose who you select for president, plain mm-hmm. and simple. But at the local, and plus the president can't determine local resources
right.
as much as anybody else. So you have these local leaders, they come out of your community. They're not these external people that move in and don't have the community shared interest. You have these people who actually live and study with the people, and they take the people's interests to whatever they're doing, whether it be an actual social movement or be an electoral position. That way we can hold both groups accountable if something goes wrong in terms of you're not representing our interests anymore. Because I believe that the really biggest problem that we have in this country, and Trump is a great example, is that there is no accountability to leadership. Leaders are allowed to do whatever they want without any accountability or any consequence. I mean, literally, Trump has violated at least a dozen of his constitutional rights as executive branch or the commander in chief of the armed forces, his official title. And yet there's maybe one whiff of talk of impeachment. Like, see what I'm saying? So it's, and that happens at the state and local level as well. You have leaders who say, I'm going to do this, and we don't question what it is you're going to do. Like, there needs to be a set of numbers that you say, okay, by this date, I'm going to increase this amount of jobs by this date. Mm-hmm. Small percentage, whatever you need, but we need to be able to judge and we need to be able to remove if you do not meet those expectations. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, that's the one thing that basically would make this a democratic system, because right now it's not democratic if there's no accountability, because I don't have to listen to the people when I get elected. In any level of government, you don't have to listen to the people. You could just serve your time and you get out. Mm-hmm. Or you stay in, they'll reelect you, unfortunately, for a lot of instances. So I don't know why people say this is a democracy when, number one, it's not in the Constitution, and number two, the elected leaders are not set to act in a democratic situation, from especially at the national level. But at the local level, people, the community has a little bit more support, has a little bit more control over what happens locally, because that person is living with you. Mm-hmm. And you get to know where they stay. And they have more than likely been out in some protests with you, or you know of them in another social setting, like perhaps if they go to the same church, or you know of their children in school. So in other words, there is a relationship that's built by them being in the community to where you should have an accountability system set for them. And once that accountability system is tested and run well, then you could possibly talk about them building stronger social movements outside of the local area. Or you could talk about them possibly being elected outside the local area. But we are far away from that. We are years away from anything of that sort, because we have not spent the time finding our local leaders and putting them in this institutions of agency, because mm-hmm. they are resources that can make our community stronger.
Well, and I think people get so disheartened because, you know, when we've talked about, when we've talked about gun violence in the community here, we've talked about policing here in the Champaign-Urbana area, and then there's this issue of, you know, when you're asking people to be on a police community relations committee, it should only be police who live here in Champaign. Because if you have people who don't live here in Champaign who are police officers and they're on this task force, again, when you're talking about vested interest, it's not there. When you talk about, there was discussion, you know, over the years, because I've been involved in the local school district, about, you know, if the superintendent's children don't attend in the same school district that they're, you know, essentially presiding over, again, where is that vested interest, or why is the school district we're here?
Exactly.
It's not good enough for your kiddos. So I think people get disheartened by that because, again, there is no accountability. There is no saying, well, if you're going to have any kind of feedback, you need to reside in the community that you're trying to work on. Otherwise, if you live outside of the community and you come in, where's your vested interest? And so I think from just that basic level, it can be really hard to think, if I can't even have say over my local school district, my local police department, how am I going to do it with elected officials? How am I going to do it with the federally elected? How am I going to, you know, the problem I think is you're taking those who already have historically felt oppressed and oppressing them more.
Yes.
Because again, they feel helpless. They feel like they have no voice. Why would you expect them to, and it's not, you know, media is so horrible. And I'm talking TV, movies are bad about making it seem like, oh, it's just this uprising and we're all going to get together and sing We Will Overcome. No, this is actual strategic planning, organizing. And I think, you know, one of the things I'm hoping to see happen across the school district is to help parents see that, again, just because your child may be a Barksdale or BTW, it does not mean that you don't have very similar interests as far as how to advocate for your child, what resources you would like to see at your child's school. We just need to come together and as parents figure out how we support those initiatives versus some people just turning them over to, you know, either school administrators or district administrators and say, you fix this. They'll always fix it, but they will do it the way they want to. And so if you want it to be done in a way that satisfies your needs and your wants for your child, you have to be involved in the process. And so that for me is always where I pushed back on some parents and said, you really have to be a part of the process. You can't just always say, this is somebody else's job to do.
Well, the thing is that, you know, historically parents have pushed and pushed to be a part of the process, but they've been actively blocked from being a part of the process.
Yes,
let's
have.
Let's take the most recent example. You know, the report came out that African-American children are performing at a worse level here than they are in Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, and this is, you know,
Should blow people's minds, because I attended the Racial Justice Task Force and heard that report and people were like, you've got to be kidding me. There's no way that's true.
But here's the thing. That's the most interesting thing about it is that people were not tearing things apart at that, because people just don't realize how bad that is.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brought to the city and the county board. Mm-hmm. And the majority of them were like, what do you want us to do? Right? And so the thing about it is that I don't want people to think that this is a personal attack. This is not about individuals. This is about the role of institutions in areas that have power. What will the county board do to fix that?
Mm-hmm.
There has been no talk about that. Somebody tried to bring a charter school thing to the forefront about it, but I'm wholly anti-charter school for multiple reasons. But the fact that nobody is actually thinking about a solution on the board, but the interests are there. I mean, the interests have to, the children are the interests, and black parents are talking about this, and yet the board's doing nothing. Is the board serving the interests of the parents?
Mm-hmm.
Or they're serving the interests of the community? No, they're not. So why are they sitting in that position? They don't have to be accountable to those numbers. I don't know about you, but if I come in to do my job, or anybody else comes in to do their job, and they don't do the job that the boss wants them to do it, what usually happens?
You get fired.
They get fired. So how come people are allowed to get these jobs? Some of them pay extremely well, and they don't have to be accountable to actually doing any work. It's not fair. We can flip it over into any aspect of it. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, when you look at working people in this country historically, we are always punished and oppressed and made to be humiliated when we can't perform a task or we can't do something with a lot of external factors involved in why we can't do it. But then when you have local councils and figures, you have the Democratic Party, you have all these entities who have not served the interests of the people, and yet they expect us to donate money. They expect us to vote for them, and they expect us not to hold them accountable, and they get to do whatever they want. And again, how is that democratic? That is extremely unfair. And it does exactly what you said. It reproduces super exploitation and super oppression to the point to where I feel powerless. I feel powerless being in this society where I can't make a decision, but I get a bill in the mail for something, for getting for $1,000 when I got stung by a bee and I went to the doctor.
Right.
And I can't do. You see what I'm saying? That the U.S. produces a powerlessness amongst the working people here that I'm really surprised at how amazing our history is of struggle and building movements and doing all this other work to do it. The way the U.S. has treated us over these, the U.S. system has treated us over these years, it just goes to show you how amazing people are. Like, we're going to fight. We're not going to sit back and let people tell us we're powerless. We're going to find it somewhere. And that's why I have all my faith in people and the way we're trending upward,
mm-hmm.
moving forward right now.
Well, I think we see that it has to be us. It has to be us taking charge of this. You know, locally, they just recently ran a story about the racial disparities regarding punitive measures. You know, we saw that there was, you know, that list that came out about the school districts who, you know, for me, it's nothing new. We've seen this locally run by the local newspaper that there has been a disproportionate number of certain demographics that are suspended, expelled, whatever it is. And it's nothing new, but, you know, it kind of happened again where people have met and talked about how do we keep our streets safe from gun violence. There's a lot of discussions going on, and people, I think, feel very, I don't know, discouraged, because, you know, you read about a lot of the local leaders getting together, but if you go to those meetings, it's really the same people who are always there. And so how do we engage the people who aren't there? And so for me, for instance, when I talk about wanting to see parents get engaged, you know, I could hold a PTA council meeting, I could, you know, go to a PTA meeting, it's always going to be the same parents.
Yep.
And I don't mean like literally the same faces, I mean the same type of parent who's going to be there. So how do we reach the parents who aren't there? And a lot of times it's because they can't always be there. We have to figure out, with our wonderful technology, how do we leverage that to engage our parents? It can't be anymore, oh, Susie's mom came and volunteered in the classroom. Not every parent has that ability to do that. So how do you find a way for them to feel empowered in their child's school to make change? When you get the right people together having the right discussions, again, exactly like what you said, around the right goal, then I think you can get parents to at least have conversation. I'd like to see more than conversation, because we do a lot of talking as a community. I'd like to see action, because I've always felt like you learn by trying what will and won't work.
Well, I mean, that last point you just said, I mean, there's a lot of talking, but there's not a lot of substantial talk. You go to meet and people are still asking questions about, oh, really? So, wow, racism does exist? Like, they're sharing reports about things that we know already exist.
Right.
And there's no actual putting together a plan. So there's a lot of, like you said, there's a lot of abstract talk, but there's not a lot of practical talk. In other words, what is the problem? How do we get here? And what are the next steps? That rarely happens in meetings that I've been to in Champaign County, unfortunately. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that there are not enough, that the people are not serious. The leadership, at least, is not serious about fixing issues, because they don't have to be. They don't have to be accountable. I mean, let's just be honest. I mean, people's feelings are going to get hurt or whatnot, but the truth is the truth. When you sit down a locally elected official in this area that's been around, like, for instance, like, what are you really doing? Like, right. what is your track record? What are you doing? You know, the only person I know of that is just out there just killing it, new county board member Stephanie Sewell for Tato. She's amazing. But when you go to some of these other, you go to these board meetings, these city council meetings, and you have people literally telling you, like, I cannot afford, if you change this housing, this housing statute in the city, I will lose my home.
Right.
Do you understand that? And there is no benefit for you to change that housing statute other than a couple of conservatives got in your ear and told you it's a good idea. There is no benefit, and you still hesitate or don't do it. There's just no interest. But back to your original 2 points. The two ways to get people more active. The first one being, ask them what their interests are.
Right.
Simple as that. These local leaders, that's what I'm saying, these local leaders do not care about the people if they're not asking them, what are your interests? I'm going to tell you that I'm worried about gun violence. Why? Because I know for a fact that when it's election season, I can always go to the certain demographic, and you know who these people are that are going to talk a lot about gun violence and link it to Black people. And I'm going to get their vote, because I'm going to tell them that I'm going to fix that problem. And I know I know what communities those are, and I'm going to police them and surveil them, and I'm going to get that vote. So you got that group that they're going to be dealing with. And let's just be honest, that's what they're interested in, is getting elected. So if they go to the people, if they door knock outside of election season, and they actually go in these people's homes and say, what is it that you're truly upset about? What are the problems worrying you? They're going to cross-reference the same issues. There'll be 3 or 4 that they're going to see over and over again. They hold a town hall meeting, and they get narratives. They get testimonials. Once they have that, they should have a 2 or 3 weekend retreat where they sit down with each other and they hammer out possible plans on how to fix these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do those things. They don't. That's why you have lack of interest, because people are saying, why should I care if they're not even going to address my interests?
Right.
So again, technology is part of the issue, but it's a small part. People truly feel, like we talked about, powerless, particularly since the local leadership has shown repeatedly, remember, you are what you repeatedly do, that you do not care about our interests. So we go along with the program, and the people need something that's going to jolt them up, that's going to get them excited. So that's the first thing. The other way you get people involved is socialization, which is a lot different now because of the spatial reconfiguration of just really everything since the 1980s. People no longer live next to the same people they work with anymore,
mm-hmm.
you know, as much as they used to. You used to just go straight from the job site or space either to a space in the community or to the home. That no longer exists anymore, and people are a lot more spread out and dispersed.
Well, and that's the same way because of school of choice.
Exactly.
We used to all be walking together as little kids to the school because we lived next door to each other. We went to the same school together, and now we don't have that anymore.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. If we have to find a way to bring back socialization to the point to where it's something that's common now. I mean, there used to be a time when you moved into a building that people would either throw a party to, like, welcome you,
right,
if you were in an apartment building, or they you would knock on their door, or they would knock on your door and
welcome
bring you
to the neighborhood
something to eat or something, like welcome to the building or welcome to the neighborhood. Those things don't happen anymore. And again, I'm not blaming us for that, though. There are external factors, and we talked about the media, and we can do a whole show on that alone, about the media pushing individualism and competition since the 1980s, that have basically made us feel isolated from each other. So we have to find a way to break through that, and it's not an easy task, particularly in this climate, especially with social media. But we have to find a way to actually start socializing together in person and doing it on a consistent basis. Because once that relationship develops from socialization, and the history proves this, that you're more willing to attach yourself to the person's struggle and vice versa, because you know that person now, and a trust starts developing, mm-hmm. to where you're willing to put yourself on the line, and then that collectivity builds across the community, and you have force at that point to force these local leaders to start doing what they say, or you're gonna do this. You're gonna add consequences to them not being accountable.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things work together. This process of social movement and building alternative spaces and structures to challenge the current structure, this stuff all works together. But we have to be able to say, and it's tough, I get it. I'm not saying that any of this stuff is easy. Just because I have answers doesn't mean that it's gonna be easy. It's gonna be tough. It's going to be ugly, and the first 5 to 10 years are going to be a struggle. But once you get past those first 5 to 10 years, and we have a new culture around communalism, around, like you said, walking with each other again, just hanging out with each other, socializing with each other, and defending and supporting one another. Not solely that I'm going to tweet what you said type support.
Right.
No, I'm talking about, I heard that you have a problem and you're going to be here. I'm going to show up with you. And if the police come, we're going to create a line to make sure you're not going to take our friend's house.
Right.
They're not coming to take our stuff. You know, I'm gonna go to the jail, and we're gonna have an all day protest together as a community until you let this person out for being wrongly charged. That kind of stuff. And again, these things are not impossible to do, but they just take effort, and they're gonna take a lot of struggle to get through.
Well, and I think we've historically seen the 80-20 rule. 20% of the people do 80% of the work. And so you're burning out the same people who are willing to be those pioneers,
sure,
or do those, that activism or advocacy work. You know, there are plenty of days where, you know, I've gone home and I'm just exhausted because I'm like, this is tough.
Yeah.
But again, if you're able to build coalition, and like,
yes,
they say, many hands make light work, if you're willing to do that, then again, it's how you start helping people to not just validate what they need, but empower them to go for that.
That's,
and find
one,
a way,
yes,
to do it. And I think that's kind of radical to some people.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's I say this in all lovingness, but it's very scary to the powers that be because of exactly that. If you get, for instance, parents to engage and recognize their rights to engage in the local district, things will start to change and the powers that be will know that they have to do their job differently. That's scary because one of a couple friends who are also involved in the district were saying, why do we have so many new positions at the district level? Where's that money coming from? And what exactly are they doing with those positions?
Good question.
But again, I think part of the accountability has to be transparency.
Yes.
So when you're making a new position, why are we hearing about it through the grapevine? Why is there not something that's, you know, beyond just a school board, you know, minutes saying this is what we did? It should be something that comes out and says, we've created this position to address this issue. Mm-hmm. And here are the outcomes we plan on in a year, 2 years, whatever it is. So again, we as parents can see if that position that was created is doing what it's supposed to be doing by the end of the first year, the second year. But parents just go along to kind of get along. And some of them is because they don't know any better. Some of them is because they feel like we've tried for so long. And others, you know, again, like we've said, it's kind of gaslighting. They think they know where to go to check, or they think they know over here to go, and somebody's saying, no, 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 if you want to find out, just email this person at the district. Or but we see that in all sorts of systems.
Yeah.
There's always, it's like a maze. Go down this road, you'll get to this person. Go down this road, you'll get to this person. They'll answer your questions for you, but their position was designed to give you a very robotic answer to shut the door on you.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, again, if you get parents who are talking, you might hear them all say, well, this is what we want, transparency. We want to know what you're doing. And then I think if we had a piece where even after, for instance, they do a retreat, let's say 2 or 3 weekends, they still need to come back to the community and say, here's how you can be a part of this work.
Of course.
Because again, if you leave it up to them, then we never know what's going on. No. So we have to be a part of that conversation. I just talked to somebody today and it was, oh, well, we're going to talk about this one way that the PTA can be involved. As a parent, I should be able to say, I want to be involved with whatever you're doing, or at the very least know what you're doing. No more of this political, you know, double talking. It's either you want a parent involved, you want to be able to report back that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, or this is just all smoke and mirrors.
It's going to be smoke and mirrors if it's by themselves. I mean,
we
have to be honest. Like I said, we have the history to prove that that's what happens. And until there's like this new significant figure that does something different than leaders have been, or the ruling class or government officials have been doing for centuries now, they change that, then we're going to go with the way things have worked, and they've worked badly. So it's like 100% agreement is that you can't do anything without the approval of the community. Whatever plans that we create together, we're going to take back and workshop with the community members to do. But again, like you said, asking them to even do something like that, you're going to get so much pushback from the local leader, because it's exactly what you said. They know that if they are held accountable and we actually are to grade them or evaluate them, they're going to fail miserably. So that's why they've actively sought to remove accountability measures at every level in history. I mean, seriously, it's like the stuff that the stuff that the presidents have been allowed to do, particularly since Reagan, all the way to, you know, Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, Bush Jr., Obama, and Trump. The things that they've done themselves, we're not even going to count Nixon. Nixon got caught, and he's doing some other stuff too. But just looking at the things that they've been able to do based on what they said they were going to do, then they all receive failing grades easily. It is not even close. And again, people like to say, oh, it's just checks and balances. You got the Congress. Guess what? Guess who controlled the Congress going back to Reagan?
Mm-hmm.
Guess what party controlled the Congress that passed all those bills that have taken our resources? The Democratic Party.
Well, when we, you know, one of the last shows that we had on elections, you know, I wanted to be able to help people understand these seats that are coming open, what those positions do.
Yeah.
So you understand if they're doing their job. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's like what you were saying. How do we know if you're doing your job if we don't know what you're supposed to be doing? Most people don't know, for instance, what the attorney general does. Do you know what you're, I mean, do you know what even your local mayor is supposed to be doing? Exactly. The city manager is supposed to be doing? Your county board is supposed to be doing? If you don't know what their exact, because they all have to sign something that says, here's what you're supposed to do.
There used to be something called civic government that you learned in school. But they took that away. And the only thing now you, because I used to teach government and civics when I taught high school. The only thing that the students have to know now is how the federal system works. They don't, and not even that, really, they just have no checks and balances and separation of powers. They don't have to actually know what each entity does in the cabinet and whatnot. And so they don't know any of the things that we're talking about. They don't know what how local and state leadership works at all. So you have a millions of kids coming out to be adults who are asked to vote for something. And like you said, they're not getting any voter education about what those positions do. And, and so they're going in voting and they're voting ignorance.
Yeah. I think that's also when you, on any level, regardless of what the system is, if you want to be able to be a part of that accountability, you need to know what these people were hired to do or elected to do. And I think that for me is one of the first steps when it comes to empowering people, because like they say, knowledge is power. So if you know what somebody is going to be able or design, their position is designed to do, regardless of who's in that position, if you know what the position is supposed to be working on, that helps you to understand if they're doing it. Then you can understand when we have all these campaigns and you hear people preaching their ideologies, you understand what that ideology can do to that position. Because I think that's also the other part where people start to lose focus a little bit, is because they don't understand what the exact ideology can do in that position to, in those duties, create problems for them. So, you know, again, that was part of that one show that I had was, okay, you need to understand that this is what this position does, and this is how it can really screw things up for you. And one of the people who was on the show, Kyle Patterson, you know, he does a phenomenal job in explaining a lot of those things in ways that people should be able to get. Okay, that might be why I need to pay attention to that position, because you know, we were talking about the governor and how the governor can, you know, change things, for instance, regarding funding for rape crisis centers. Well, it may not necessarily affect you, but what if it affects the parent who's in, you know, comes into the PTA or the parent-teacher conference after you? Or what if it affects one of your teachers? Or what if it affects your neighbors? But we start to be so inorganic about how we connect with people, we lose that appreciation for what other humans need. And so again, that socialization piece is so critical as well. And I would love to see parents go back to, you know, when I was in school, you know, my mom knew what was going on with other parents in my classroom, because in her mind, that's just what you do. And if they have a need as parents, we should figure that out. But we've gotten away from that. We really have gotten away from that.
Oh, it's not even a question. I mean, it used to be literally that nobody was like, oh, they, you know, we shouldn't get these things, because again, there was never a problem with money in the U.S. until the 1980s. Well, 1970s with the Volcker shock and all that stuff. But before that, though, there was never this issue of, well, we don't have any money, we can't fund schools, we don't have any money, we can't send it to the states, or I mean, states can't send it to the local areas, so this group's broken. This, that never existed before the 70s and 80s. The political economy created by this structure had reduced so many resources to the point to where it forces us to fight and scrap and say, that group doesn't deserve this. That group doesn't deserve this. The money shouldn't go here. The money should go there. Because again, this is all manufactured foolishness by this system. Both parties are both negligent in allowing this to occur. The system produced this. Because before, there was never any... My whole thing with this is that, and yeah, you're right, Cal does an amazing job. Cal's another one, like Stephanie Furtado, that is out there actually doing work. But again, there's so far and few between. I mean, you know, that's just how it is,
unfortunately. It's the 80-20 rule.
Yeah, we need more people like that doing those things. But the thing about the inorganicness, I thought you brought up an amazing point, that there really is this kind of, it's almost like it's an automatic, if it's not me, then the first thought that comes to my mind is, why should I care? Mm-hmm. that is such an interesting and fascinating turn from the way it used to be, to where it was like, yeah, unless it's, and again, this is, I'm not encouraging this, but I'm just saying that people allowed all these things unless it was with a person or group they did not like.
Right.
That, so it was a second or third type of question, but it was just like, yeah, go ahead. But now it's like, I don't want you to have this, is the first thought. That is the foundational breaking point to why we haven't had a successful movement, or a moment hasn't turned into a movement in this country in decades. It's because of that very thing, is that we can't get past this. If it doesn't affect me, why should I care? Mm-hmm. That was a question that you would never hear,
right,
40, 50 years ago.
Well, I had a friend who's in the local school district, and she's just phenomenal to work with. I love her. She's kind of breathed life back into me when I'm like, okay, I can't do this anymore. But she texted me today and said, hey, got this person I know. They're in a financial need. She knows I'm a social worker. I have a network here. Can you help her? And I was texting people right away saying, hey, I got this situation. Do you think you can help out? And hopefully you found that bridge where there's an entity in here in town who can help her out with her small financial need right now, and was able to turn it around pretty quickly. And she, you know, they were both very appreciative, which is great. But again, my parents taught me that if you can, you do, period. And they were also big believers in, you're part of the problem or part of the solution. There is no gray area whatsoever. And inaction is definitely action. I think we've missed out on that generation. Yeah. But that generation also went through wars that we've never seen. And yeah. 9/11 was pretty significant to us. But we are not raised with the same mentality that our great grandparents and our grandparents were raised with. And I think if we can do that socialization piece, and you can sit down and feel good about yourself because you helped somebody else, I think if we can get people more connected that way, and then bring our younger generation in to do the same thing, where we're teaching our kids to volunteer, to help their friends, I think there's something that you can't deny, that when you help somebody else, there is something that lights up in you and you're like, oh, hey, like my daughter, she's 12. She's worse than I am when it comes to pioneering stuff, but she also gets that she's capable. And so I think that's how we change the next generation, to say you're capable. You have power, but it's how you wield that power that counts. It makes it different. Just having power doesn't mean anything. It's how you use it. So I'm hoping that, you know, in future shows, you can come back on and we can definitely keep talking about this, because it's helping people to understand what those steps are and what the realistic organizing looks like. It's definitely, not just definitely. Sit in a meeting, talk, everybody has the same goal. It's no. We got to make action steps. Yeah. But I will definitely be having you back on my show. Definitely appreciate awesome. It. You got some amazing points. I think this is a way, again, like I said at the top of the hour, where we have to talk about yes. things in a very real way that some people aren't always okay about talking about. Yeah. I would like to see, you know, more as far as, you know, how we bring these types of conversations into the community,
yes.
but make it constructive and productive.
Of course.
Not just everybody sit and say, oh, hey, yeah, we all sat and we met and there's a newspaper mm-hmm. article on it. Woohoo, we're heroes. No.
No.
But yeah, thank you so much for being on the show, guys.
Thank you for having
any
me.
Any shout outs you want to do about any upcoming events?
Ooh. What is going on? There's so much happening right now.
Is there a website people can go to for?
Yeah, the IMC is a place you definitely go to. I think it's ucimc.org.
Oh, and they have a teen workshop coming up next Saturday. I'll put it on my Facebook page, but they have a teen workshop coming up next week, which is going to have some good political discussion and ways for people to get involved. So that'll be great.
Yeah, but anything the IMC does, I mean, they have just profoundly transformed
shout out
that
to Brian.
Space into just in the, I mean, it's really one of the greatest spaces in the county. Now they are doing so much progressive work for all groups, and whatever your goals are, they're mm-hmm. open for you. So I just want to give a major shout out to the IMC, just for, like, I mean, it is, and check the website for all the different events they have, because they have events almost every day.
Well, Brian will be on my show next week, so everybody great. Tune in next Monday. We're going to have a discussion more about immigration, because I think still people don't understand all of that. So we're going to yes. talk next week about that. Thanks, guys, for being on my show.
Thank you.